Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Since 2001, the U.S. has been aggressively fighting an ill-defined war on terror. The attacks on September 11th successfully shocked us into a place where committing our weapons, wealth, and lives seemingly became part of our new 21st century fabric in America. Since the victory in World War II, America has had and used very often an amazing military arsenal. And the old expression, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, has been shown to be very, very true. Since 2001, under these three presidents now, our military has been very active in a great many corners of the world. The goal, at least for American civilians, has been to bolster our security, to prevent more such shocking and terrible attacks. Has it worked? Are we more secure militarily and economically because of our global military exercises? Have we become too dependent on purely military solutions while diplomacy has not even been given an opportunity to better resolve threats? As compared to his predecessors, Donald Trump is displaying a now thoroughly undisguised, rather overt determination to reestablish unquestioned American domination of the world through military superiority. How is that likely to work? Why is it so difficult for once imperial powers to transition to less bloody, far more cost-effective means of living peacefully and prosperously in the world? Our guest today, author Nicholas Davies, writes, "The transition from hegemony to coexistence has never been easy for any great power, and there's nothing exceptional about the temptation to use military force to try to preserve and prolong the old order. This has often led to catastrophic wars and has always failed." End of quote. History is full of obvious and vital lessons from which we can learn so much, yet Western imperial powers, specifically the UK and the US, seem rigidly determined to ignore those obvious lessons. Today we're going to talk about why that may be, and what it may take for us to choose a more productive course. Well, maybe it's just the fun of the bang-bang and the immense profitability of such adventures, but even those not insignificant factors, what will it take? Can it be done? What is so powerful about this obsessive need for militaristic world domination? Well, our guest again is Nicholas J.S. Davies. Thanks for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bert.
Nicholas Davies is the author of Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq. He also wrote the chapters on Obama at War in Grading the 44th President, a report card on Barack Obama's first term as a progressive leader. How progressive he was, that's another discussion. In Orwell's
didn't write the title.
In Orwell's 1984, there was something called Hate Week, whereby Big Brother made sure everyone knew there was an enemy to be hated. It seems we have pretty much defeated ISIS after George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq led to the creation of that terror group. It took virtually no time before our military leaders shifted the focus to a new enemy. Seems to be China, As you point out, Secretary of Defense Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, announced in January 2018 that, quote, our competitive edge has eroded in every domain of warfare, air, land, sea, space, and cyberspace, and it is continually eroding, so says Mattis. What he did not say was the reality that, as you point out, much of the chaos seen around the world is the direct result of past and current military adventurism. Okay, how has America's military adventurism sown the chaos across the world, the problems we now aim to fix by beefing up our military? What is this chaos you say we have sown?
Well, I mean, we could go sort of around the world and look at each place. I did an interview last night on RT, on RT International, so I'm not sure if anyone could see it in the U.S.
It's limited.
Talking about Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is now the longest war in U.S. history.
Yes.
It was the first one that the U.S. launched after September the 11th, really about a month after September the 11th, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld went to Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri as the first B-2 bombers prepared to take off to go right around the world and drop their bombs on the people of Afghanistan, who, of course, had nothing or very little to do with the terrorist crimes in the U.S., which were mainly committed by Saudis. And he told these bomber crews as they prepared to take off, he said, either we are going to have to change the way we live or we are going to have to change the way they live. We choose the latter, and you are the ones who are going to assist in this venture. So that's, my colleague who wrote the preface to my book on Iraq, Ben Ferentz, the former Nuremberg prosecutor.
Oh, wow.
I first heard him on NPR less than a week after September the 11th, saying that, it can never be legitimate to punish people who are not responsible for the crime committed. And if we just bomb Afghanistan, we're going to kill a lot of people who had nothing to do with this.
Yes.
And, that's, of course, what we went ahead and did. And here we are,
yep,
16 years later. The BBC... the BBC has an Afghan language service, and they did a survey of the whole country recently. They found that 14 district capitals are now under full control of the Taliban and its allies. The Taliban is now active across 70% of the country. And of course we've heard in the news about, just horrific bombings by both the Taliban and Islamic State right in the heart of Kabul, the capital of the country, and, killing hundreds of people. And Trump's response to this, all of this, has simply been to send more U.S. troops, still nowhere near the number that Obama sent in his previous failed escalation of this war. And Trump has ramped back up the U.S. airstrikes to close to the level they were at the end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration. People may not realize this, but since 2001, the U.S. has dropped 67,000 bombs and missiles on Afghanistan. And until that was eclipsed by Obama's campaign in Iraq and Syria, that was the heaviest bombing anywhere since Vietnam. And, really, for those last two or three years of the Bush administration and the first three or four years of the Obama administration, the U.S. was conducting about 100 airstrikes every week in Afghanistan, week after week, year after year, for about 6 years. And so, you know, the idea that ramping back up the airstrikes or sending a few thousand more U.S. troops is going to change this situation and alter the absolute failure of the U.S. and the government it installed to gain control of the country is a complete fantasy. And, the only solution is, of course, as you said in your introduction, diplomacy. At some, the Taliban refuses to negotiate until U.S. troops withdraw.
Right.
But ultimately, the different factions in Afghanistan are going to have to talk to each other with some kind of international mediation, perhaps, but probably not from the U.S. that keeps discrediting itself as an international mediator from Israel and Palestine to Afghanistan to just about everywhere else.
Yes.
And in fact, the people of Afghanistan have a long history of, they have this tradition of a jirga where everybody sits down together and works things out peacefully. Tribal leaders and representatives of all different parts of their society have a long history of working these things out. And, but the U.S., as always, is this question of imperial credibility. And, of course, Donald Trump famously will never admit to being a loser. But the fact is that the U.S. has lost the war in Afghanistan.
Of course
and,
it has.
So we need to be thinking about how we get out and how we empower some kind of diplomacy or negotiation, and who could actually fulfill a legitimate role in facilitating it, so that this can be peacefully, in the end, worked out between the people of Afghanistan.
Well, there's no question, Nicholas, we have very effectively sowed global chaos, obviously, in Afghanistan, which has been, I believe it was Winston Churchill who called it the graveyard of empires. And here it is, a very poor country, and we've bombed unbelievably amount. It's just, we don't see it every day here in America, but the people in Afghanistan do. And interesting, you described the jirga. I had not heard about that, but that's, once again, not understanding the culture, feeling like, we did that in Vietnam. We had no idea what their culture was, but just came in and, this is what you're going to do. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. Our show is called Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a group effort, believe me. We're talking with Nicholas J.S. Davies, who has written an article called National Defense Strategy of Sowing Global Chaos. It seems to me that if we want to defeat our enemies seeking to do us harm, it would seem to be useful to learn why they do what they do. You cite a United Nations Development Program which did get an answer as to why most people who joined armed resistance or terrorist groups do so. Please tell us what that found about why people join this armed resistance or terrorist groups that the UN found.
Yes, well, and this is part of a growing body of evidence. I think the critics of the whole war on terror from the very beginning have been very clear in trying to tell the public and our government that using violence, using state terrorism to try and defeat non-state terrorism, it was always doomed to failure, because in fact, of course, it is state terrorism that turns non-state actors into terrorists in the first place. And in terms of applying that to our current state of war with various groups around the world, and the growing and the huge expansion of U.S. special operations forces under President Obama, you know, who dispatched special operations forces to, you know, something like 150 different countries, and now under Trump, you know, if anything, that has expanded further, if that's even possible. But there are now U.S. special operations forces operating in countries across Africa, and this UN Development Program survey actually I actually asked about 500 Africans who have joined different groups, whether it's Boko Haram in Nigeria or Al-Shabaab in Somalia or Al-Qaeda in the in West Africa, and they the title of the report is called "Journey to Extremism in Africa: Drivers, Incentives, and the Tipping Point for Recruitment." So they asked these people what it was that drove them, what incentivized them to join these groups, and what, in fact, was the final tipping point that led them mm-hmm. to that fateful decision to essentially give up their protected status under international law as civilians and become combatants. And while, of course, all discussion of that in the West revolves around religion, in fact, it found that religion was not, you know, the major motivating factor. In general, people were motivated by desire to protect themselves, their families, their communities, and usually against some form of state terrorism or, you know, so-called counterterrorism operations or operations by often U.S.-trained local security forces. And the actual tipping point for 71% of these 500 people they talked to, the actual tipping point that led them to make that final fateful decision to join an armed group was, in fact, either the killing or the detention of a close friend or family member by either foreign occupation forces or local security forces. And so we, you know, this absolutely confirms what, as I say, critics of the war on terror have said all along, that in fact, you know, these kind of purely militarized, security-driven approaches to the problem of terrorism are, in fact, the very thing that have been the cause of terrorism from the very beginning. And so, you know, we were now seeing this growing body of evidence really documenting this in the case of, you know, resistance fighters and terrorists in not just in Africa. There's a researcher named Lydia Wilson from Oxford University who works with retired U.S. General Doug Jones, who was once in charge of all detention facilities in U.S.-occupied Iraq. And he began his own research, actually talking to his prisoners back then. But they likewise have found really the same answers to their questions, that people join these groups ultimately out of self-protection or protection for their families and their communities. And you know, and most of them do not cite religion as a factor in that. Even people joining, you know, very extreme what we call Islamist groups, like Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And in fact, you know, these are political armed groups. You know, when people take up arms to fight their own government or to fight a foreign government that's invaded their country, you know, this is a political act. This is, you know, there may be a religious ideology from the leaders of the group that they've joined, but what, you know, what we really have very well documented now from all this research is that what drives people to join these groups,
sure,
is not so much religion, but it is politics, and it is pure survival.
Survival.
It is for their own protection. And, of course, this is why they are always drawn to the largest, most powerful, and seemingly most effective group. So once a group rises to the fore, such as, you know, the what was called first the Nusra Front in Syria, which is now called the Jabhat al-Sham. But then, of course, along came Islamic State, which seemed to be an even more radical, more powerful, better armed group than al-Nusra. And so thousands of people flocked to join that group instead. And when they went into Iraq, these mainly Sunni Arabs, Arab Iraqis in the west and the north of the country, people in Fallujah, Ramadi, Mosul, places that have been devastated by the U.S. occupation and where people have been systematically detained, tortured, and murdered by the security forces, by the death squads that the U.S. trained during the occupation beginning in 2004, that when Islamic State appeared, it really appeared to many people in those parts of Iraq as a lesser evil to being ruled by a sectarian government in Baghdad that kept sending sectarian death squads to come and torture and kill them.
Yeah, it's amazing how many examples there have been through the last 100 years or so. I mean, the people in Vietnam, a lot of the so-called Viet Cong, the National Liberation Front, they many of them had no idea about communism versus, you know, the democratic alleged democratic government in the South. They were fighting for survival. They were bombed. They attacked. They wanted to be able to feed their families. You know, how much does it take to learn that stuff? And certainly American military intervention across the world did not start with Trump. No question. We could go back to Teddy Roosevelt, but let's start more recently, as you talk about, with George W. Bush. You observed, far from establishing the Pax Americana, promised by policymakers and military strategists in the 1990s, from Paul Wolfowitz to Dick Cheney to Madeleine Albright to Hillary Clinton, the results have been consistently catastrophic. End of quote. What was the vision of that Pax Americana in the Middle East, for example, and what was the catastrophe that instead resulted from the Cheney-Bush neocon policy?
Well, I think, you know, we started hearing in the 1990s, whereas, you know, when the Cold War ended and the Berlin Wall came down and everybody was celebrating and, you know, the buzzword of the time was peace dividend.
Yes, I remember.
You know, this is what we and really the whole world expected after this long, long ideological conflict, you know, that had justified, you know, trillions of dollars spent on weapons and military forces on both sides. And so, you know, there was a small reduction in the U.S. military budget by the first President Bush and by President Clinton. But they never, in inflation-adjusted terms, they never actually reduced it below what had really been the baseline of the Cold War, the baseline that U.S. military spending fell to after the Korean War and after the Vietnam War. And so this, essentially, as Bush the First celebrated at the end of the first Gulf War. He said, you know, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome. And essentially, you know, he used that war to save the Cold War military-industrial complex by the putting on this fantastic display of so-called precision-guided weapons, which they didn't tell us at the time were only 7% of the bombs and missiles raining down on Iraq and Kuwait. But that's what they were. It was, you know, but of course they were the ones, you know, that were beamed to everybody's TV sets all over the world to show, you know, how wonderful U.S. weapons now were. Mm-hmm. And then they ordered pilots to fly direct, U.S. pilots to fly directly from Kuwait to the Paris Air Show, which conveniently was just happening at that point, to sell. And the next 2 or 3 years were just record years for U.S. arms sales, which made up some of the for the weapons manufacturers. It made up some of the cuts in U.S. spending. But General Wesley Clark talks about stopping by to see Paul Wolfowitz at the Pentagon at that, precisely that time, the end, the triumphant end of the first Gulf War. Mm-hmm. And Wolfowitz was very upset that the U.S. had not, you know, continued the war and, in fact, invaded Iraq at that point. And Wolfowitz said to Clark, he said, you know, we can use military, now with the end of the Cold War, we can use military force with impunity.
Ah.
And he said, we have about 5 years to clean up these, what did he call them? You know, the rejectionist, former Soviet-backed regimes around the world. And you know, what we started hearing then was talk of a unipolar world, talk of the U.S. as the world's sole superpower. And the idea was that, you know, the U.S. now had unchallenged military superiority.
Yes.
So we could use that unchallenged military power to sort of clean up the world, to do away with any regime anywhere that objected to, that's wanted to be independent from the U.S. dominated world, and of course it didn't happen in those 5 years, but a lot of the ideological groundwork was laid for it under the Clinton administration. And so then when the neocons actually came to power, mm-hmm. they had broad bipartisan support,
yes.
to launch this sort of new imperial project, which Senator Edward Kennedy, by the way, condemned as a new imperialism.
Interesting.
And said that the rest of the world would reject. And of course, he's right. As we saw with the invasion of Iraq, you know, there was no real international support for the U.S. using its military power in that way. And as a result of that, whereas in Afghanistan, only 68% of the foreign troops who have been killed were American, in Iraq, which we did unilaterally and with
right.
very little international support,
right.
93% of the occupation troops who have been killed in Iraq were Americans.
Wow, sowing chaos very, very effectively. What a heck of a strategy. Now, what would you say to people who say, well, you can't talk to these people? I mean, you got to, you know, just the only thing they understand is force. And you and I have heard people say that, you know, those of us who talk about a different way of doing it would be called naive. What's your response to that? Is what you're talking about naive, you know, that, oh, come on, you know, we got to just whack these guys really hard into submission so that they will do our will.
Well, I think as Ben Ferenc predicted a week after September the 11th, you know, that has not worked very well. You know, we have not succeeded in whacking these guys into submission. And, you know, I, as you say, these guys, this is sort of the way it's framed, you know, the the bad actors, the bad guys.
They're all the same.
You know, just, you know, in the U.S., we are so isolated, really, from the rest of the world. Yeah. You know, we have an ocean on each side of people like Trump vilify Mexicans and anyone from south of the border.
Yeah.
You know, Canadians seem quite nice, and you know, but in general, Americans are kind of, sort of taught that, you know, the U.S. is exceptional in its democracy, exceptional in our prosperity, and the world beyond our borders is a dangerous place. Of course, you know, in reality, you know, it's the U.S. that's more dangerous than any other developed country, with, you know, 30,000 gun deaths every year. You know, that doesn't happen in any other developed country. And in fact, even in 2001, when we had this horrific terrorist crime that killed 3,000 people, right, you know, that was still only 10% of the violent deaths in the United States in that very year. Wow. And so, you know, this whole notion of these bad guys out there in the rest of the world, and the U.S. as the safe haven, is a really distorted picture. And as we were talking about, you know, these surveys and studies of what drives people to join groups to resist U.S. imperialism, you know, most of them are not, you know, just some sort of dyed-in-the-wool bad guys who, you know, the only way to deal with them is to kill them. As they used to say during the Cold War, you know, the only good red is a dead one, you know. And now where we've transferred that sort of attitude and that sort of language to, you know, so-called terrorists. But as we're finding out, I mean, the very definition of a terrorist is it's a civilian who picks up arms, you know, doesn't join an actual army,
right,
you know, under the power of a government, under the authority of a government,
right,
but, you know, picks up arms and fights independently of a government. But these people are civilians in the beginning.
Yes.
So, you know, to understand what turns a civilian minding their own business in some country somewhere in the world into a quote-unquote bad guy, or one of these guys, as you called them, is really a critical understanding. You know, if we actually have any real desire to solve these problems, you know, I think the mistake, if you can call it a mistake, by our leaders over the last 20 years has been, you know, this assumption that this overwhelming imbalance military power that our country now wields can solve these problems. That, well, you know, we don't have to understand these people,
right,
because,
right,
you know, hey, you know, they're the ones causing us trouble. We can just go and kill them all.
Right.
And of course, you know, that has not worked. And as wise people said in 2001, it was never going to work.
No.
Because it really ignores the political dimensions of the problem. It ignores the personal motivations of why people join these groups.
Yeah.
And it ignores the complete mismatch of, as you say, when the only tool we have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Surely it should be dawning on most Americans by now, and even on our deluded leaders in Washington, that this problem never was a nail, and our hammer is simply going around the world and smashing things and creating more problems.
Yeah, it doesn't help us particularly. I mean, when you look at people being terrorized from the air, England in World War II, Vietnam in that war, did they give up? Heck no. They fought more. It inspired them to fight more. It's really not complicated.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, an American study during World War II, after they gave up so-called precision bombing, because, you know, a British study found that, you know, the precision bombing, the effort to sort of hit individual targets on right. the ground, you know, factories or railway lines or bridges, you know, on average, the half the bombs actually missed by more than 5 miles from their targets. So they gave up on so-called precision bombing. You know, today, you know, we've been sold this narrative of precision bombing, but in fact, you know, the experts during, you know, the shock and awe attack on Iraq in 2003 estimated that about 75 to 80% of those bombs were performing with precision, in other words, landing within about 30 feet of their targets. So, you know, we still had 20 to 25% miss rate, even with those precision weapons then. And the precision weapons were only about two-thirds of the bombs we dropped on Iraq anyway. So really, about half the bombs dropped on Iraq in 2003 were not performing with the kind of precision we were led to believe. So the Allies in World War II then adopted what they called area bombing or carpet bombing. And the express purpose of this, as you know, said by Winston Churchill and other British officials, and as shown in British documents, was to quote unquote dehouse the civilian population of Germany. And a U.S. study, I think by the Rand Corporation, found that in order to actually reach a point where that kind of bombing becomes demoralizing of a civilian population, you have to destroy 70% of the homes in a city. And of course, even that was still quite theoretical at that point, because they hadn't really done it. But no, certainly anything up to that point actually stiffens people's resistance. And in the case of, you know, the U.S. war on terrorism and the U.S. wars on countries in the Middle East and Afghanistan, it's been well documented. It was documented in Pakistan that U.S. drone strikes turned people against the U.S. and against it didn't discourage them from joining the Taliban or joining Al Qaeda. It had exactly the opposite effect.
Yeah, it's a heck of a.
In fact, Pakistan now is a country where, you know, the U.S. has sort of record low approval ratings.
Oh, sure.
Almost nobody, you know, a tiny fraction of people in Pakistan now see the U.S. as a force for good in the world or respect U.S. leadership because they've seen hundreds of U.S. drone strikes just kill thousands of innocent civilians in their country.
Yeah, the drones, it seems, are a tremendous recruiter for the other side. And you,
exactly,
Nicholas, have researched and written about Obama. I'll never forget during his 2007-2008 campaign. It wasn't his campaign, but some entrepreneurs made a button with, it said Obama, and there was a peace symbol on it. That was not the case, putting it mildly. There's no question he was not averse to picking up the proverbial military hammer and using it, despite a different image, what you call sugar-coated charm. How much of a hawk was Obama, really, and how much chaos did his administration cause and contribute to?
Well, the rate of drone strikes in Pakistan under Obama was 10 times the rate of drone strikes under Bush.
Wow.
So he vastly expanded that whole campaign. And under Obama, we saw, you know, a U.S. and NATO invasion of Libya that, destroyed the Libyan government of Muammar Gaddafi. you know, under the same kind of demonization. Of course, he had long been one of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Reagan had launched a bombing campaign, essentially
true.
Aimed at assassinating him,
yes. and,
which killed one of his daughters.
Yes.
And the UK also had supported an assassination attempt against Gaddafi using an Islamist group made up of so-called good guys who had returned from the CIA and the Saudis' war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan and against the Afghan government of the time. A lot of Libyans went to fight there, and when they came back, they formed this Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and with the support of Britain's MI6, they tried to assassinate Gaddafi too. When that failed, they were all given political asylum in Britain. Some of them then went back in 2011 to join the rebels fighting their government in Libya, and in fact overthrowing the government.
Right.
And a young man from, you know, that group, he was 16 at the time in 2011, but his father took him to Libya when he went back to fight Gaddafi. And that young man ended up, you know, killing dozens of concert goers in Manchester. So he was part, you know, really this was
wow.
an absolute case of blowback where, you know, the UK supported these radical extremists trying to overthrow Gaddafi, and one of them ended up coming home and conducting one of the worst acts of terrorism in British history and killing, you know, killing other young people like himself in Manchester where he had grown up.
Yeah.
And so... You know, this is all such a deal with the devil. You know, the U.S., you would think after September the 11th, after people, groups that the CIA had supported in Afghanistan in the 1980s, when they turned around, like Osama bin Laden, recruited
yes.
young Saudis to come and kill Americans in the U.S., you would think we would have learned our lesson. But no, under Obama, the U.S. again began supporting these kind of Islamist groups, like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, in Libya to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. And then they were so pleased with that. You know, we've all seen videos of Hillary Clinton crowing,
oh,
we came,
yes.
we saw, he died, about Gaddafi. They immediately, the CIA started flying these fighters from Libya to Turkey to infiltrate them into Syria to do a repeat performance against the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. You know, they had to know from the
mm-hmm.
very beginning that the war in Syria would be much more long drawn out and much bloodier than the war in Libya, which is a relatively unpopulated country. It's, I think, maybe 5 million compared to something like 25 or 30 million in Syria. You know, Syria is much more densely populated with large cities. And yet Obama supported that from day one. It was his CIA flying in fighters from Libya, flying in the weapons from Libya. Thousands of tons from Libya were loaded onto ships and shipped to Turkey and then infiltrated across the border by the CIA into Syria. There's an excellent article by Gareth Porter from about 6 months ago titled How the U.S. Armed Terrorists in Syria.
Yes.
And he provides meticulous details of these weapons shipments. Once they got the weapons from Libya into Syria, you know, the CIA then worked with the Saudis and the Qataris They used the CIA's contacts in the Balkans, mostly through Croatia, to fly thousands more tons of weapons. And we're talking about heavy weapons here. We're talking about howitzers. We're talking about anti-tank weapons. We're talking about thousands and thousands of rocket-propelled grenade launchers. And these were all flooded into Syria to militarize, you know, what had begun as peaceful protests. And the groups that launched those peaceful protests in Syria, you know, wanted no part of this. You know, this was the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamist party in Syria was very, very small before this. And the protests were begun mostly by leftist and socialist parties who wanted, and they formed a group called the National Coordinating Body for Democratic Change in Syria. And it was committed from the very beginning and all the way through to three basic principles: non-sectarianism, non-violence, and no foreign intervention in Syria. But
we couldn't have that.
Obama administration think of that? Obviously, nothing. They didn't care. They were determined to launch a proxy covert war to overthrow the Syrian government.
Ah, chaos. It's so much fun, but it's really, I mean, we joke around about it, but it's thousands and thousands of people are dying. It's not making us any more secure. If anything, clearly, it's exacerbating the problem. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is called Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Nicholas J.S. Davies, who's written an article, National Defense Strategy of Sowing Global Chaos. There's so much evidence of that. And looking at Iran, I mean, the chaos in Libya is unimaginable, and it didn't need to be done. But moving on to Iran, Trump's Republicans and some Democrats are absolutely apoplectic about the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, so-called, with Libya, the nuclear deal. It effectively prevents Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. What is the real reason behind this fierce resistance to this nuclear deal with Iran?
Well, frankly, I'm afraid to say that, you know, this is really driven, you know, by these same military industrial interests that, you know, that have caused all this chaos, that have, you know, that saved the U.S. Cold War military and then unleashed it on country after country in the name of fighting terrorism. And as I ask in my article, you know, how will the U.S. justify its global military occupation, illegal threats and uses of force, and trillion-dollar war budget once serious diplomacy is seen to be more effective at resolving international crises than the endless violence and chaos of U.S. sanctions, coups, wars, and occupations? The truth is, you know, most wars are ended by diplomacy. Most international problems are solved by diplomacy. And, you know, the effort to replace diplomacy and international law as the rules of the international world and replace them with, as I say, the illegal U.S. threats and uses of force has been a catastrophic failure. To give Obama his due credit, when it comes to Iran, he eventually, in his second term, after ramping up sanctions and threats in his first term, he eventually, with John Kerry at the State Department, they eventually seriously did sit down to negotiate the kind of agreement that Iran had been open to all along, despite all the propaganda in the West. Iran, after September the 11th, had cooperated with the U.S. in Afghanistan, its neighbor. It had tried to help the U.S. to stabilize Afghanistan. Iran had never been friendly to the Taliban, and it was supportive of what the U.S. claimed to be trying to do in Afghanistan. And after that, Iran approached the Bush administration offering negotiations and diplomacy to work out a comprehensive agreement on all issues, to, you know, all the differences between the U.S. and Iran that had persisted since the Iranian Revolution in 1979, and of course the occupation of the U.S. embassy in Tehran at that time. So Iran had won, and then even during Obama's first term, Brazil and Turkey approached Obama and got his approval to conduct their own diplomacy with Iran. And they got Iran to agree to essentially an agreement that the U.S. had put on the table 6 months earlier. But by that point, the U.S. thought it was on the verge of getting the U.N. to the U.N. Security Council to impose very tough sanctions on Iran. So at that point, the U.S. rejected its own deal. The U.S. rejected its own proposal to Iran from 6 months earlier when the Iranians agreed to it with the mediation of Brazil and Turkey. And so Trita Parsi, who's the president of the Iranian-American National Council, wrote a book about the failure, Obama's failure of diplomacy with Iran in his first term. And he interviewed the senior person on the Iran desk at the State Department, who was a former hostage at the Tehran embassy himself. And he told Parsi that the real problem with Obama's diplomacy with Iran at that point is that the U.S. does not seem to be able to take yes for an answer from the Iranians. And so what changed in Obama's second term was that under Kerry and under the U.S. stopping this policy of constantly ramping up sanctions and threats of war against Iran, they actually sat down and, of course, were able to work out this JCPOA, this agreement with Iran, under which Iran has mothballed all the centrifuges which it had spinning and creating 20% enriched uranium, which of course is still nowhere near enough for a bomb, but which it had, under the threats and the sanctions, under the sanctions that prevented it obtaining any kind of nuclear technology from overseas, Iran, which is quite an advanced country, just developed the capability to produce those things itself. Iran has, the International Atomic Energy Agency has never found any real evidence that Iran ever took the first step towards militarizing its nuclear technology, but it wanted nuclear power to generate electricity.
Right.
It wanted to do to have the capability to use nuclear energy in medical applications. I myself was treated for a benign brain tumor at Shands Hospital in Florida for a brain tumor. Iran has patients that need those technologies too, and so these are the kind of peaceful, peaceful uses of nuclear technology that every country is entitled to under the nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and with the CIA and the Mossad and Britain's MI6 kept trying to tell the IAEA that Iran was using these technologies to develop a weapons program, and the IAEA never managed to substantiate any of those claims.
Well, but bombing is so much more fun. Attacking.
So this has been resolved now.
Yes.
Through serious diplomacy.
I got to ask.
It has done what serious diplomacy.
Yes.
Treating another country with respect and sitting down around a table and working out an agreement that can be satisfactory to all sides.
It can be done.
Has achieved what sanctions and threats never achieved.
Well,
and so this. You know, this is a model that can be used instead of our proverbial hammer, you know, on all these problems around the world. And you know, North Korea now presents another test case for whether we can act, whether the U.S. might actually be willing to take yes for an answer and sit down and talk to the North Koreans. As the Clinton administration did in 1994, at that point, North Korea agreed to completely scrap its, all its nuclear developments, to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to abandon building two much larger nuclear facilities. It's still today, because of that agreement in 1994, the North Korea still only has the one small research reactor that it built back in the 1980s. That's the achievement of Clinton's diplomacy with North Korea in 1994. Now, today, after Bush withdrew from that agreement, on the instigation of John Bolton,
right,
who worked at the State Department then and really made, you know, absolutely false claims that,
yes,
North Korea was violating the agreement. In fact, it was the U.S. that was violating it by not delivering on the clean reactors the light water reactors that it had promised to build for North Korea. And now, you know, now with all the threats against North Korea, they seem to be convinced that the only way they are going to prevent a massive U.S. attack on their country, a second Korean War, and the first Korean War killed somewhere between a fifth and a third of North Korea's population.
Yeah,
that the only way they can avoid that now is to actually develop an effective deterrent to actually prevent the U.S. attacking them.
Yeah,
and this is why they, they already had some bombs, and what they have done in the last couple of years is to develop the ballistic missile technology to give them a credible nuclear deterrent. So to persuade them to give that up now, it's going to be a long-term project.
I'd say,
and
well,
it will require the U.S. abandoning its threatening posture towards North. It will require the U.S. actually guaranteeing peace.
Well, what a concept.
And as I say, that will be a long-term project now, because everything we have done for the last 15 years only encourages them to believe that they are in real danger.
Yes.
Seeing what happened to Iraq and Libya after they gave up their nuclear weapons program, the North Koreans have every reason to be very skeptical.
We've come to the end of the hour, Nicholas. I got to cut you off here because I think there's some evidence that history is moving in a number of different directions at once, because a lot of white male, aggressive Republicans are stepping down. More and more younger people, women, are stepping up. There's so much to learn from history. There is so much to learn. We have thus far refused to learn it, but I think there's some degree of hope. Thank you so much for being with us. Very, very informative here. And we've been so effective at sowing global chaos for so many years. Thank you, Nicholas Davies.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on, Bert.